Okay, so I guess thank you for joining us in tonight's session, our second session. There was some interest in people getting the recording of the first session, but that recording got lost, so I might actually do a repeat, or maybe we could just review if there's any interest in reviewing what we discussed last week. Rethinking from last week, I realized that I only really stopped for questions at the end. And I feel like maybe you have questions as we go along. I thought that wasn't so considerate of me. So this week, I'm going to pause for questions in between each subject that we cover. Okay. So last week, there were a couple of questions, holdovers from this week. And I talked quite a bit about different sparring that you might use. In particular, I pushed for the Mitsuda over the Arsenal for younger kids. And there was a question at the end of last week about a good dictionary. And I don't have a good answer for that question. You know, a lot of dictionaries are geared towards modern Hebrew. And there's definite differences between modern Hebrew and biblical Hebrew, which we will talk about in today's session. That's why I'm bringing it up. And on the other hand, there are like specific dictionaries meant for biblical Hebrew, but those are often extremely advanced. I saw Rav Hirsch has a beautiful dictionary, but it's really very, very advanced dictionary. You know, I guess we're already familiar with Hebrew quite a bit in order to use it. So I really feel that the person uses the Mitzudos Chumash, you know, the lines are so short and it's so evenly broken up that it could almost serve as like a rudimentary dictionary for the words that are there. So I think that coupled with a basic dictionary for Hebrew, even if it might be geared towards modern Hebrew, should suffice. But if someone here knows of an actual dictionary that is a good fit for biblical Hebrew and is not for the advanced user, I'd love to hear and see a good dictionary like that. So because as of yet, I haven't found a good one. Okay, so let's get to some of our main topics. You know, young kids will begin learning Hebrew by either knowing nouns, you know, that they recognize the same way they learn English, but when they begin to learn Chumash, they're gonna be stringing words together. And more often than not, they're stringing more than one word together to, you know, two or three words together and then repeating them. And here is like a really big difficulty that English speakers have with learning Hebrew from the Chumash. And that is the sequence of subject and verb. And you know, it's something that's very natural for people who've been doing it for a long time, but for kids who are just starting, it kind of sounds like Yoda speak. You know, a simple pasuk like Vayidaber Hashem or Moshe Lemor, and Hashem spoke to Moshe saying, could be very difficult to translate because they want to translate each word one at a time, and then it's not going to work. Vayidaber, and he spoke. Hashem. So he spoke to Hashem. And they already got it wrong. They're already confused. And it's just because, right, a person needs to see that Vayidaber and recognize that Hashem goes into the Yud. So seeing getting the word order down can be very, very tricky for a new Chumash learner. And the Rebbe of the Mora is gonna make his choice or her choice about how to string words together. And we talked about this last week, trying to copy the same stringing of words sequence that the teacher uses. That because it's gonna be helpful because this is really, this like difference between Hebrew and English is like a mental block that kids will eventually get over, but they have to hear it over and over again. Vayidaber Hashem, those two things have to come together. I was watching a video a while back of this young guy who is obviously an expert in language. He's an academic, and I think he knows like 100 languages. And he was going through, you know, he was doing like a video on like each language, what's special about it. So he talked about Hebrew. I didn't watch his other videos about other languages, but in Hebrew, he said, two things about Hebrew. One, she said it's interesting, fascinating, that it's the only language that ostensibly was a dead language, right? Didn't have any people who spoke it as a first language for some time, and was resurrected. And there's no other language like that. There's no other language that had, you know, basically no speakers of that language, or, you know, no first language speakers. That was resurrected. So that's pretty cool, and I think we could take some pride. We take some pride in that. The second thing that he said was about Nekudos, that, you know, the language has vowels. The vowels are in these symbols, but like the pattern of the language is so consistent and so word building. So the conjugation of the words is so systematic. In that sense, it's like a pure language. Not, you know, it doesn't have, it's not influenced by outside languages. So you don't need to write the Nekudos, and like they suddenly disappear, you know, on street signs in Israel. And the third thing that he said is, and I think he said other languages all like that too, but the third thing that he said, I think, I'm pretty sure he said this is unique to Hebrew or maybe to Semitic languages, is that the word order doesn't matter. And that's not always the case, but frequently subject and verb, it doesn't really matter whether the subject comes before the verb or the other way around, right? You could say Moshe diber, vayidaber Moshe. They mean the same thing. They mean the same thing. And for a kid to recognize that is difficult. And I think, you know, if your child is familiar with Yoda from Star Wars, that could actually be helpful to realize that, like, you know, there might be another way to say something that sounds funny, and to recognize that in Hebrew, you know, the way in which you might say something in the word order is different. And it takes a lot of time. We have to be very patient with our kids before they realize that, before they learn that, before it becomes natural to keep reading, to find the subject in the sentence. But if we recognize that it is a new thing for our kids, then we'll be able to have that patience and help them in a kind way, you know. Read one more word before you try to translate it. And in that kind gesture and with some encouragement, our kids will eventually get it. But again, we really need to give them time, and we never jump on them, which is a point made last week. But to recognize that it is really, this is the hard part about Hebrew, the sequence of the words, and that, you know, there might be a pronoun in a word, and don't translate that pronoun, because the subject is still coming in the next word. Okay, so that's the first comment about word sequence. I don't. Anybody have any questions on that piece so far? Okay, let's see what's happening here. Okay, so that was topic number one, and I'm gonna kind of revisit that topic or bring it to the next level when we talk about breaking words down. But on the topic of breaking words down, there was a question from last week about graphic organizers or highlighters and such. And if you learn with your child on Shabbos, then Ashrecha, that's fantastic. You know, learning, that's the best. That's what Shabbos is for, in a certain sense. That's amazing. But if you are learning during the week, or you're going to like some kind of Motzi Shabbos program as Shabbos ends earlier and earlier, I think it is really kedai, really worthwhile to have a small notepad with you while you learn, because, you know, you might not want to write in your chumash, but it is actually helpful to circle certain words or highlight certain words. So to have a small notepad with a highlighter and a pen, so that way you can rewrite certain words from the Chumash. And if you're learning Chumash, then he's already familiar, he should be familiar with script. So you might not be familiar with writing print, but you could write in print or script. And to highlight a certain word. So for example, you know, if I got to this word, Vayidaber Moshe. And, you know, as soon as I could write it down, and I could already begin cutting out the words. And this might be difficult at a chumash. I don't want to write in it, but on my notepad, I could make the point that these are prefixes. And really the word is daber. And once I could do that, it's easier for my student to see what the show is. So having a pen and pad, again, it's not shadows, is extremely helpful for learning. We should be prepared, you know. We don't have to rush in the middle to go get it. Try to be prepared in advance. And especially in a context like this, right, the Ber Moshe, and we realize that the Yud here is really a placeholder, because Moshe is the one who's going to be speaking. And, you know, we can show that the Yud is not going to be translated in this, right? Yud normally means "and he," but the Yud disappears because in the next word, it's right there. So, you know, to cross it out in that sense and put in Moshe's name, put it back inside, and then help the child realize the sequence, right? Der Moshe is going to be translated "and Moshe said." So being able to make like that football chart where, you know, suddenly the subject is moving into the verb to translate it and to bridge the sequence difference between Hebrew and English, having a notepad is extremely, extremely helpful. You know, once you've done it a few times, then on Javis, of course, you could reference it. Everyone should learn with their kids on Javis. That's the best. But having a pad during the week is really great. Okay. So highlighters and pads and sequence of words and helping our children see that the words that we're looking at, Vayidaber, have prefixes and some words have suffixes, right? Familiar with that in English, and teaching that our children that there are roots to words. And that's something that even though English has as well, but they're not necessarily cognizant that Hebrew has, that English has root words and that they're conjugated, and you know that running is connected to run. They're not necessarily going to see, you know, going to know that or how, why it's being conjugated in that way. But in Hebrew, they're going to be much more conscious of it, because they're not necessarily speakers of Ivrit. If they're just learning Chumash, they're probably not. But for them to recognize that there are roots is much more important for them in learning Chumash than it is for speaking English in that sense. So I think in that sense, it is new. It's new, and reinforce what the teachers are teaching them, that there is a root word and there are prefixes, and then focus on the root word, focus on the Shoresh, and then they'll be able to figure out what the word is, deconstruct it. We need to support that. And obviously highlighting will help us pick up on the root word. And you know, it could be difficult, and we don't want to put pressure on our kids. And that's like one of the key things. When you're with your kid, again, it has to be calm and it has to be like a safe environment. So we don't want to make like challenges for them. You know, what's the shoresh of this word? That might be too much pressure, but more like perhaps more something similar to what are the letters that are similar between this word and then another word? And that it's much easier for them to do, to recognize the similar letters from one word to another. So we had our word Vayidaber Moshe. So, you know, putting down a similar phrase, right? And to tell them, you know, to show them Daberu, and to have our student realize, like, you're not asking them a challenge. What's the show rest? You're saying, what letters can you find that are similar? And that's much easier. That's much more like a game. Can you find similar letters for this? Then you tell them what that word means, and they could go back to the first word and figure out how they're connected. And changing what is really like could be seen as a test or an assessment, and it makes a kid feel like they're back in school, and changing it instead to a game, and you know, can you find the similar letters, will really change the atmosphere of learning with our kids. And having a notepad obviously is going to be helpful for something like that. But even if you don't have a notepad, even if you're learning on Shabbos, there are games that you could play with these root words. And you know, last week we talked about bringing our Chumash learning into the rest of the week or the rest of our time. So when in benching you come across a word that the child knows, a word as easy, or you know, child has said a bracha, and they said the word barach. Well, maybe they know that word because they started lechacha and they got va varechacha. You can ask the kid, how are these two words related? You know, and your child can fit fine beis reisha, that, you know, those three letters. And to realize that we make a bracha, and we didn't know this before, it seems like we're going to get blessing to God. So that connection is so easy and so simple, but we shouldn't overlook that our child might not know what a bracha means. But if they've learned the first two psukim in Lech Lecha, then they'll be able to make that connection. And I think figuring out these riddles and seeing these as riddles as opposed to tests can really change a child's perspective on learning Chumash. One night I was thinking of some of these things, and I was testing this idea on my children. And I started with a very, very easy one. I said, you know, the word for green in Hebrew is yarok. Yud, resh, and then a vav and a kuf, yarok. And the word for vegetable is yarek. Right? Yud, resh, kuf. Why do you think they sound so similar? And like my kids thought about it for a while, and I think Devorah gave an answer. We're giving an answer. Vegetables are green. They grow from things that are green. They have green leaves. And then I kept doing that. I kept thinking of other, you know, simple nouns that they might be familiar with, and other words that they're not necessarily familiar with. And by the time it was over, my daughter said, she says, "I know Hebrew so well. I'm a genius." So you know, that's kind of what you're going for, setting up these very simple riddles or games. And she's like, "Ah, but give me more. You know, give me more Hebrew words." So that's really what we want. We want our kids to have, you know, to see it as fun and to have that drive. And of course, learning Chumash is hard work. And of course, it you know, being in school means doing classwork and breaking down words. But they should also know that it's fun, and we shouldn't make it hard work. We should try to unravel it from being work, and to instead have it be a game as much as possible. So thinking about connected words and focusing on the root word and finding the root word in other places will help our children build connections, will help our children realize that their learning also takes place outside of school, outside of Chumash time, you know, throughout their whole lives. Their, you know, Hebrew is part of their lives. Okay. Anyone have any questions on this on that part? If you're really interested in some really interesting riddles about like Hebrew words, then I would recommend Rav Hirsch's dictionary, which I said before I'm not going to recommend unless you're an advanced learner. But it has really interesting connections between different root words. And on a side, it's not so important for teaching kids, but we should realize that other languages are often corrupted by globalization, right? There's like an influence of new words, and modern Hebrew also has influence of new words, but biblical Hebrew is extremely pure. And, you know, the root words are all within itself. The Tanakh is the dictionary of Tanakh, right? If you want to know how to use the word in Tanakh, it's how Tanakh uses the word. That's it. So it really is an interesting opportunity to see kind of like a scientific approach to how a language develops to learn Tanakh. Okay. Okay, so we have word order, we have singing, we have focusing on root words, creating riddles, making Hebrew words into a game. And part of the game, I think, needs to be prizes. And this could be like a cause for tensions and shalom bias about, you know, how much candy we give our kids. But I think we need to give our kids candy when they learn. You know, if they sat down to learn with us, we need to give them candy. If they have a sharp question or they have an insight, we need to reward them with giving them candy and the like. And you might feel uncomfortable with it. You might feel like, you know, they should be learning Lishma and they should see it for what it's worth. They shouldn't be measuring it based on candy. And all those things are true. They shouldn't be measuring so much based on candy, and they should see it for its worth. But our kids are kids. And of course, they're not ready to think about those things yet. They're not ready to experience those things yet. The Rambam himself discusses this. He says that when a child starts learning, they should be rewarded. The Rambam says they should be rewarded with candy. And I think he's talking about like roasted candy nuts. And then as the kid gets older, the Rambam says, as the kid gets older, he should get nice looking stuff, you know, get him nicer clothing. And the Rambam says he should get shoes, he should get nice shoes for learning. I don't know if you knew how expensive sneakers were going to be in the 21st century, but that's what the Rambam says. And says eventually, he says, La'olam yasak b'torah u'mitzvah shelo lishma. A person should always be learning Torah mitzvahs, even shelo lishma, mitoch shelo lishma balishma. Even though they're doing they're learning Torah, not for the sake of Torah, but it'll come. It'll come eventually. If there's positive associations with Torah learning, then it's eventually they'll get there. I heard a story about someone who was in Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky's class. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky is a Tzal's class in third grade, whatever he taught in Canada, and he had them over for Shabbos, and they were asked, you know, what was it like to be with Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky for Shabbos, and the answer was, it was a lot of candy. The whole Shabbos long, he was giving them candy. So, you know, not necessarily recommended for us to give our kids candy all the time, but I think it is important to reward our kids for learning with us and for getting a sharp answer or a sharp question, because we need to make sure that it's a fun and positive atmosphere. If our kids get upset, or if the questions are formulated as a test, where they think it's a challenge, they're not gonna want to learn with us. They're just gonna check out. You know, Rabbi Matinki once was telling me about parsha sheets, and he was pretty upset that like his kids would come home with these long parsha sheets with 10, 12, 13 questions. Some of the kids love getting those questions, and they're ready to answer all of them. Other kids feel like it's a test. So Rabbi Matinki told me that, I don't know if he did this all of his kids or one of his kids, he didn't tell me which one, but he would just throw it out right away, and he would just turn to his kid and say, is there anything about the parsha you want to tell me? And the kid would say yes, the kid would say no, and that was it. And you know, it was a kind of no pressure zone for that child or for all his children. Wasn't clear exactly about that, the details of the story, but it's the idea that we have to be so careful not to put pressure on our kids when we learn with them, and so careful to encourage them and be rewarding. So that's what I have to say about shorashim and word buildings, to recognize that there is a big gap and a big difference between speaking English and speaking Hebrew, and recognize that the subject often has to be put into the verb, right? That was the football play that I showed before. And that's kind of hard for the kid. And using a pad and a visual to help show that could be extremely helpful, right? It's not Shabbos. And continuing with that visual of picking up on Shorashim and connecting that Shorashim to other places can also be very, very helpful for our children who are just learning about Shorashim. Okay, any questions on the topics covered so far? Okay. All right. There, I guess we could kind of already begin the next topic. I'm definitely going to cover this topic more next week. But that is for some of our students who are in fourth and fifth grade, or maybe towards the end of third grade already. Our kids will start learning Rashi. And it's even more important to get down the prefixes and the suffixes and, you know, what each one connotes, you know, how to, you know, when it's a plural, when it's a singular, to learn Rashi and to learn Rashi properly, that is right. Initially, kids will just be learning Rashi as a kind of pirish, just, you know, adding more to the story. And if our child's teacher has taught them a Rashi like that, then we should accept that you know, that's what the teacher chose to how to teach this Rashi. You know, Rashi just adding more words and helping us see what else is going on in this story. But we should tell our child that you know, even if they're not necessarily ready to pick up on exactly the question of every Rashi, that Rashi is not just you know, saying random comments on the psukim, but every time Rashi says something, every time there is something about the pasuk or about these psukim that is unsettling. There is some problem with the pasuk that Rashi is dealing with, and Rashi's answering that problem by explaining this midrashic idea, or by expounding on this concept. So, for example, in the beginning of Lech Lecha, this week's parsha, and many of our kids will start with Parshas Lech Lecha, Rashi says on the word Lecha, Rashi says Lehanascha, for your benefit. So a child might learn that Rashi tells us that Hashem sent Abraham for his own good. It's for his own good, Lech Lecha. Okay. Others, you know, child might be confused when he learns that this is Lech Lecha is really one of Avram's nistionos, one of Avram's challenges. So how does that fit with the word, with this idea, Lehanascha, for his own good? For us to realize that, and we have to know this and try to express it to our kids, that Rashi was bothered by something in this pasuk, which is that Hashem could have just said, Lech me'artzecha, mimolatcha, leave from your land. There's an extra word in the pasuk, and that's the word lecha. So Rashi's not explaining, not just telling us like the character of the nature of this pasuk, of this command of to go, it was for Abram's own good. But Rashi's interpreting a word that would otherwise is surprising in his presence. It doesn't have to be here at all. Hashem could have just said, Lech me'artzecha. So this is a little bit of a tricky state. You know, our child's teacher, Mora, has chosen to just teach this Rashi, that this test was for Abram's own good. Rashi says, Lahanascha. And at home, we want to try to, you know, learn this with our child. But I think it is important to tell our kids that Rashi said that because the pasuk demanded that something be said. But the pasuk itself, it wasn't just an extra thing that Rashi chose to say. And our kids need to, I think they need to have that be reinforced. Otherwise, they're just going to get the sense you could just say whatever you want and suck him, or that Rashi just says whatever he felt like saying. And that's not what's happening at all. It's Rashi is being precise. He's being scientific. He's motivated to say something, to say everything that he says, because of the words in the psukim. That's why everybody has so much to say about Rashi. They're trying to figure out what Rashi's saying. I told some of my students this year, I asked them the following question. We will talk more about this next week. But I asked my students the following question. I says, let's think about two people. One person has learned and memorized every single Rashi on Chumash. And another person has gone through all the Rashis on a single Parsha, and he's figured out what was bothering Rashi about every single Rashi that they learned. Which person knows Rashi better? So you might think that the first person knows Rashi better because he literally knows every Rashi, but that would be incorrect. The second person, even though he's only studied one Parsha, he knows Rashi better because he knows the person behind the words. He knows the way Rashi thinks. He knows what was bothering Rashi about each pasuk. He knows how Rashi learned each of those pasukim. He doesn't just know the comments of Rashi. So that second person knows Rashi better. And if we learn Rashi this way, to try to break down, figure out what about the pasuk was motivating Rashi, so we will grow. We will grow by knowing content, but we'll also grow in the way we think. We'll be asking those questions too. We'll be paying attention to those features. We'll be much bigger people. This is true for us. This is true for high school kids, and it's also true for elementary school kids. They need to be prepared to know that the Mefarshim are coming to answer things. They're not just adding comments. They're just going to be confused. Our children are going to be confused if that point is not reinforced. And eventually they'll appreciate why it is that everybody learns Rashi. Why it is that all the schools across the whole spectrum of Judaism, Orthodox and not Orthodox, they're all learning Rashi. And once you get the questions of Rashi, you realize that the other Mefarshim are also learning Rashi. They're also learning Rashi. So I'll talk more about the kinds of questions that Rashi asks. And you know, when we come upon a question that we could explain to a young learner, how we should take the time to do that, and perhaps which kinds of questions are a little bit too difficult for a young learner to see and kind of just leave them as, oh, this the Rashi had a question. And, you know, how to make the point without having to spend so much time to explain what that question is. We'll talk about that a little bit more next week. So just a quick review. What did we say today? We talked about creating a kind, as kind and happy an atmosphere by giving out candy and changing, you know, challenging questions into puzzles and riddles, finding the same letters. We talked about having a notepad could be helpful, and playing games and singing the word sequence, right? Asking our child to read one more word to fill out the sentence. Try not to translate after Vayidaber, but Vayidaber Hashem, it would be easier to translate. And then lastly, we made these points about Rashi, which I like people to think about how to talk to our kids about Rashi when sometimes the questions might be beyond them, even though the answers are not beyond them. And we'll talk more about Rashi next week. If anybody has any questions, I'm happy to take any question.
I have a question.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Oh. Yeah, I can hear you.
I don't know if you already covered this, but what if your child's teacher teaches them a medrash as if it's part of the Torah, or teaches a medrash that it might be allegorical, but teaches it, you know, literally. How would you approach that with your child?
Yeah, it's a very dangerous situation to be in. Just to, you know, spell out the problems or the challenge in that place is, you know, if a medrash is too, you know, if a medrash is obviously allegorical, so then when our child realizes that later down the line, they're going to get confused and be like, wait, was I taught a lie? And if we try to challenge on the spot, you know, the child might misunderstand what you're saying and say, wait, my teacher's not telling me something that's true. So it is definitely a sticky situation, sticking point. And I think in order to like bring up that topic, we first need to have our kids mature enough to the point that we can realize that there can be such a thing as a true metaphor, or there's an idea that's being expressed here. And what that idea is being couched in a metaphoric way. And that could take a lot of time. But I think that's a really great conversation to have, you know, for us to see that point out. Tali, do you want to give us, do you have an example for us?
Do I have an example?
Yeah, it definitely happened with me as well. you know, I'm trying to remember an example myself. I do have a great example. I just thought of one. I just heard one, but yeah, did you have one?
Yeah, I feel like the famous example is the whole story of Nimrod and Kipshan Ha'esh with Abraham. You know, that like, I was an adult by the time I realized that that wasn't written anywhere in the Torah.
Right. So that's actually a different kind of example, I think. So I'll discuss that one in a second. But the one that I just heard my wife scream out from the other room is the story in Parsha Shmos of Bas Paro pulling out Moshe from the reeds. Right. And the pasuk says about Tishtachas Amasa, she sends out her maidservant. And Rashi has this beautiful medrash of her arm stretching out. So it's really great that we're talking about learning Rashi inside, because Rashi himself says that medrash is not the pshat of the pasuk. So this is a really great example that one way to look at a medrash and to help us appreciate what's happening is actually looking it up. Rashi on that medrash specifically says the pasuk means she sent her maidservant, because that's what the word amasa means. Chazal are saying in midrashic idea that she sent her arm and her arm stretched out. So what does that mean? Rashi just told us it means that the pasuk means she sent her maidservant. What does that mean? There's a midrashic idea that she sent her arm out. So that's exactly the point. It's a midrashic idea, not to make something up. It's a midrashic idea to say that she was striving to do something that should have been out of reach. It should have been out of reach. She could raise a Jewish child in the palace of Paro in Egypt when there was an order of mass genocide, of infanticide. That's an action that's out of reach. Yet she strove towards it, and a miracle happened. God helped her. She was successful. She saved this baby, and in a sense, she raised him into being Moshe. So it's hard to figure out what Rashi's saying. That's what this idea that I just described, you know, what it means that she sent out her hand is, you know, it's a difficult metaphor, but in that Rashi itself, Rashi is insistent that it's a midrashic metaphor, because, you know, he says explicitly, can't be pshat on the pasuk. The language is her maidservant. I'll give two more examples. So one example, Ty, you just said, that's the Kipshan Ha'esh. So yeah, that's in Medrash. So this one, luckily, this one is already dealt with by Nachmanides. You know, I guess we kind of do this Medrash one at a time, but I guess the answer is to ask someone or to look it up. But Nachmanides says about the Medrash, about the Kipshan Ha'esh, he says that we know that Hashem saved Avram from something at Ur Kasdim, because the pasuk specifically says, "I am Hashem who saved you from Ur Kasdim. I took you out," in the same language that's used by Hashem and the Jewish people in the first of the Aseret Dibros. No Hashem Elokecha should seek Meiras Mitzrayim. So the Ramban says, obviously Hashem saved Avram from something. What was it? So the Ramban says, we're not sure. Maybe Chazal have a tradition that there was a Kipshan Ha'esh. But maybe not. Maybe they just know that he was saved from something and they're trying to reconstruct it. So if this was a more advanced class, I would tell you, yeah, if they're reconstructing it, I know exactly why Chazal chose a Kipshan Ha'esh. And that's because there is another episode in Tanakh of a Kipshan Ha'esh, which is straight up in the Psukim, in Sefer Daniel. Nebuchadnezzar makes an idol. Everyone's supposed to bow down to it. You know, people from Ur are in that town, are in that story. Nebuchadnezzar himself is perhaps from Ur, obviously hundreds of years after Avram. And the rule that Nebuchadnezzar makes is that anyone who doesn't bow down to the idol is thrown into the furnace of fire. And Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are, you know, they refuse to bow and they're thrown into the furnace of fire and they're saved. So for the Ramban notes, like for Chazal to try to reconstruct how Avram was saved from Ur Kasdim, a story you don't know, and to recognize that Nimrod worships fire because that's what they worship at Ur Kasdim, and we see a parallel story in the Nebuchadnezzar, it's very likely Chazal are creating this midrashic idea, not as a metaphor, but to try to reconstruct what might have happened. So you know, sometimes a medrash is filling in the hole, and sometimes it's giving a metaphoric idea. I think in the Kivshan Ha'esh story, they are perhaps making a kind of like a detective work to try to figure out what may have happened. Not necessarily that it's a, I don't think it's a metaphor. I think it's something happened. What happened? Maybe this is a suggestion as to what might have happened. It's a good suggestion because there is an that actually happens to other people. Okay, what's another story? Oh, I'll give you one more story. This also, I guess, is more relevant for older kids, but a teacher was very surprised and struck that a student of hers said that she was teaching a medrash wasn't true, was all made it up, because she had taught this medrash that in the story of Korach, in Parshas Korach, that Korach's children, his sons, they didn't die. They were saved. They were saved. While Korach was being swallowed, somehow they weren't swallowed. So the teacher told me that the kids a certain student, you know, expressed this exact point of challenging Midrashim, you know, because I'm making this up. I don't believe it. That Korach's kids were saved. The teacher was very distraught. So I told them, you think you're quoting a medrash, but it's Pesukim in the Torah. Because the Chumash later on goes through the list of the people, and Korach's children are there, and the Pesuk specifically says, Korach, B'nei Korach lo-mesiv. They didn't die. So Rashi's medrash is not so much a medrash, it's just a reference to other Pesukim. And I think like 10 Tehillim are written by descendants of Korach. So it's just, you know, to recognize that sometimes Rashi's Medrash is not as midrashic as it first seems, but it's actually coming from Pesukim, and you know, and to recognize Rashi's resolving difficulties with his choice of which midrashim he brings, that I think is very important. And we want our children to be challenging, but we don't want them to be challenging teachers by saying, you know, the teacher is telling me things that's not true. My father said that this medrash is not true. We don't want things like that to happen. It's, you know, we have to figure out exactly the right way to have that conversation with each of our children. It is really important. I would think the earlier the better. I would think the earlier the better. But they have to be mature enough to recognize that there could be things that are more metaphorically true. I know midrashim are exciting, but I think we shouldn't like veer into teaching midrashim. I think if Rashi quotes some or medrash, that's, you know, it's important, but we shouldn't just go and read through the little medrash says, or you know, here's an exciting medrash. Let me tell my kid. I think that's dangerous. They're often extremely allegorical, and our children are not yet ready. Our children are not necessarily ready to see the allegory in midrashim. I think we should definitely veer away from midrashim that aren't being specifically quoted by Rashi. When we learn with our young children, when they're older, we can learn all the midrashim and explain all the allegories that they have. That's a great question, Taya. Okay, any other questions? Okay, everybody have a great night. Next week we'll talk more about learning Rashi's. Maybe I'll have a comment or two again about midrashim if I think about this one some more, because it was a bit of a good question. But everybody have a great night. It was good to see everybody. Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.